In this session, we will take a brief look at the geography of the ancient Near East and also of Israel. And I hope that you learn some things because you see some locations that you may not have ever really thought about before. And you thought, oh, I heard about that. But where was that place? And we'll deal with the big picture here in both the ancient Near East. It looks like this in terms of our modern Middle East. The mountains are still in the same places. The rivers are basically the same places. They've shifted over the years. But the geographical boundaries between countries has changed pretty significantly. You'll see in some ways they actually do hold the same locations, though, for some of them. For example, Arabia, the Arabs, Arabia, that's still the same as it was back in biblical times. The name Israel is what we find in the ancient times. And Egypt is in the same place, and Syria. Besides that, pretty much all these other countries have all changed names from our Old Testament time. So it's helpful to know these locations. It'll help us to even understand biblical prophecy. For example, if you turn to Ezekiel 38, it says in the last days, Cush, Persia, Meshach, Gog are going to attack Israel. None of those names are the names that we have for those countries today. And this becomes very relevant to know Bible geography because we have to understand what those names were and what they are now to be able to look in the future to understand Ezekiel 38 and 39. Meshach is actually Turkey. Cush is down here south of Egypt. We call this the country of, you know what country? South of Egypt? Ethiopia. Actually, Cush is not. Yeah, I don't think Cush is involved in that. But there's an alignment with one way here in the north and Persia, which is modern-day Iran. So knowing these ancient locations, we'll be able to understand the scripture much better. But let's look at Mesopotamia. Any of you understand what Mesopotamia means?
Yes.
What is it, Matthew? Yeah, this is the cradle of civilization. This is where, biblically speaking, mankind came from. From a secular standpoint, they would say out of Africa. But biblically speaking, we say no. Adam and Eve were not in Africa. They were in the Middle East. But honestly, all this has all been changed so much since the flood, you really can't pinpoint a place where the Garden of Eden was or anything like that nowadays anyway. This is so hugely different. But to understand what we've got from the Old Testament standpoint, it starts with the Persian Gulf, where the rivers emptied into that came from this cradle of civilization. But you'll notice, I haven't told you yet, but on the upper right-hand corner of every slide is, on most of the slides, there's a number. That number will correspond to where you are in the notes. It saves me time by putting that up there and not having to refer to the page of the notes, so you can just go on up there and you'll be able to see it. So here on slide 4, we have the maps of the Old Testament and the modern world. So feel free to just go up there, and then you can, if you want to, take notes on that page. That'll keep you from having to have a separate place to take all these notes. I find that sometimes when I go to seminars and when I'm the student, if I'm frantically taking notes, I really don't learn that much because I'm spending so much of my time trying to figure out, well, how do you spell that? And where is that? And what is that? You know, so my style of teaching is more provide as much as possible for you, and then you can add to it. You can clarify some things that are not so clear. You'll see that two of the major rivers of antiquity empty into the Persian Gulf. The northern of those is called the Tigris. Right? Still has the same name today. The southern is called Euphrates. Now, you could get those easily mixed up, so how can you remember the Tigris is above the Euphrates? I try to think of these memory ways, memory devices to help me remember that. Tigris sounds like tiger, right? And Euphrates sounds like you. Okay, so if you are with the tiger, do you think you will be on top of the tiger? Or do you think the tiger will be on top of you? Yeah. I doubt that any of us would be riding the tiger, right? I think the tiger would be on top and you would be on the bottom. And that helps me remember, oh, that's right, Tigris. Tigris is on the north, Euphrates is on the south. Those are the major rivers of ancient, what we call Mesopotamia. And Mesopotamia, any of you know what the word Mesopotamia means? And you have any musical background? You know what meso means? Are you ladies sopranos? Any of you altos? Okay. What's a meso soprano? Can she sing higher or lower than a soprano? Meso means half. It means partway. So a mezzo soprano is her octave range is between the soprano on the high and the alto on the low, in the middle. So mezzo has the idea of being in the middle. How about potamia?
It's a land.
That's its surrounding land. It's actually the word potamia means a river. It refers to the rivers that are going cutting through the land, dividing the land up. If you ever go to Washington, D.C., the capital of the United States, you'll see we have a river called the Potomac. Potomac means river. So to say that's a Potomac River means to say it's a river river. It's a little redundant.
So, river bank.
I think it has the idea of a river, it's the river itself. So Mesopotamia would refer to the land in between. That's between those two major rivers. And obviously, with huge rivers like that, this is a very fertile area. People need water, so you're going to find Mount Ararat is actually in the northern part of here. And this is where, after Noah and the flood, the people migrated down into this plain. It was a very fertile plain. And we find them building the Tower of Babel and wanting to basically stay there instead of scattering around the earth as God had intended. God was wanting them to be more rural rather than urban, I guess at that point you could say. But anyway, that's all. The people who lived there, antiquity, it can be helpful to remember that Assyria was up in the north. All right, and then south of Assyria were the people of Babylon. And south of Babylon was the land of the Chaldeans. So here's Chaldea. So I think you've got those. Yeah, you've got Assyrians and Babylonians and Chaldeans there in your notes. That hard to remember? That's about as easy to remember as ABC, don't you think? Assyrians, Babylonians, Chaldeans. So if you can just remember ABC right in the land between the rivers, with the tiger on top of you, you pretty much can get the basic geography of ancient Mesopotamia. Now notice these large mountains that separated the people of Persia from the Mesopotamian region. They ended up with a different culture and a different language over there in Persia, which we would call Iran today. That's how geography works. When you have rivers, they separate people. When you have huge mountain ranges, you end up with different cultures on either side of them.
Same the bush, that part you're talking.
So modern-day Iranians would be ancient They would be...
Which one is the mountain range?
So here's this long mountain range that goes from the northwest down to the southeast. So this mountain range separated the people of Persia. Maybe I could put the Persians a little bit over to the right, maybe, from the people of Mesopotamia. And today it does as well. The Iranians and the Iraqis really don't get along so well. Yes, they're Muslim, but they speak different languages. People of Iraq speak Arabic, and the Persians speak Farsi. And this is why there was a 10-year war back in the 80s between Iran and Iraq. These kinds of barriers came about through, at least in part, because of geographical concerns. Yeah, good insights. Any other questions?
A lot of people are asking where is the Garden of Eden point.
Where's Eden?
Yes.
That's a very difficult question to ask or to answer. Actually, what I'm going to do, I'm going to insert here, expand this presentation a little bit, and give a different view of that, because I actually get asked that question a lot. So I'm going to go to my Old Testament survey course. I've got a whole lot of slides from Genesis 1 to 3, 249 slides right now, but a couple of them I think relate quite well to this, although I'm wondering if I actually have them as part of this presentation. I think I actually might have them here's where people have postulated where the Garden of Eden was. Some say a northern location because the Tigris and the Euphrates River are very close together here in the north, up in the mountains, the headwaters, if the beginning places of the Tigris and the Euphrates, and then they both come on down and they actually meet down at the Persian Gulf, so you have Tigris and Euphrates there as well. If you remember in Genesis 2, it mentions Tigris, Euphrates, the Gihon, Nile, right? There's four rivers that said that came out of Egypt. Those four rivers. I don't think you can actually take our present situation and get those from there, though, because I think that the things changed so significantly during the flood that I'm going to go to my teaching on Genesis 4 to 20, because the whole geography was so upended during the flood that that I don't think we really can tell about these things. Yeah, I think the whole earth was broken up at that time. I tried to actually look it up here on my Genesis one as well, but I don't think I've got it actually here.
So actually,
but it was definitely broken up in a huge way.
But the flood is affected. Because
yeah, here I'm showing this same thing about how Ararat comes up from there. But I'm trying to remember where I actually have this teaching about this that shows the various how things were how, how things were really broken up. Maybe I'm going to actually cover that later, so I don't need to deal with it in any significant way right now. So perhaps I'll just hold off on that right now. But I think we actually had the world all in one place. All of the continents put together, but those continents were actually broken up during the flood in such a climactic way that we can't really tell where Eden was at that time. Oh, actually, here it is right here. This is what I was looking for. I'll add these slides to our presentation on... on the flood. Yeah, so it's difficult for us to think in terms of actually where Eden was, because we've got things broken up so much during the flood, during the time of the flood. So rather than us thinking about a northern or a southern location for Eden, what biblical creationists are arguing for now is a single piece of land, a single continent prior to the flood. It is called Rodinia, the world that perished. This comes from Answers in Genesis, a ministry that studies this quite a bit. And they have a lot of PhD level geologists and other scientists that are working for them. That doesn't look very familiar to us, but this is the movement of the continental plates to their present positions. I believe that took place, but I don't believe that took millions of years to take place. In fact, just this past week, I don't know if you heard the report, but the Russians have discovered a huge amount of water underneath the continents. And this is exactly what Genesis 6, Genesis 7 says, that the foundations of the deep were birthed, they burst open. And to do that would have caused this massive shifting. These various continents would have broken up and moved, if they just moved 12 miles per hour, not very, very fast. People can run 12 miles per hour. And did that for 1 year, they would have gone to our present locations. But that would have certainly destroyed the original location of Eden, so it would be kind of pretty hard to find the Eden today with that. And any, is that clear? That's a great question. I wondered about that one myself for many years. I've had to realize that this idea of the breaking up of a single continent into the continents really has, this is what the scientists say. I think the scientists are right about this. I just think they're wrong about how long it takes. When you've got floating continents and you've got such massive shifting, you really can have it happen in a much shorter period of time than people think of today. In any case, where we end up today are three major areas as relates to the Old Testament backgrounds that we're studying. We're either talking about Egypt, and maybe along with that, along with Cush to its south, modern day Ethiopia, or Israel in the middle, along with many other groups that were there, Canaanites and Amorites, etc. And then we've got Iraq in our area of modern Mesopotamia today. Because this is where the water was located, the river's going on up here through modern-day Iraq, and then the water's coming on down through Israel with the Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, etc. And then obviously the Nile River, the longest river in the world, this is our fertile place. And you notice that it comes as a crescent. And so We refer to this area to be the Fertile Crescent. I don't think I've got that in your notes on page bottom of page 15. If you have a highlighter, perhaps you can highlight it with the color that you use with the Fertile Crescent there in the bottom. That's what that little design is there. So if you want to, if you have a green highlighter, you can make the Fertile Crescent green, and then you can highlight it in green here, or whatever. Just so that you know that this was a crescent shape. This doesn't look like a crescent shape in the lower right-hand corner, but it forms an upside-down crescent. And these are two of the four major areas of water you have in the world today, actually, over here in Asia. People need water. So civilizations have been founded from the west along the Nile River or Mesopotamia that connects together, or the Ganges River. So you see Indian civilization developing there, and then the Yellow River over in China. Those four major areas were the four major areas of antiquity for civilizations that were competing against one another, if you will, in terms of who could write first, who could trade the best, who would be the strongest, etc. And so that's the basic idea there. And I think trying to find Eden is not going to be helpful, because the Pishon River and the Gihon River are actually in Saudi Arabia and in Ethiopia. So we've got along, and then you've got the Tigris and the Euphrates. Those four rivers are mentioned in Genesis 1 and 2. Genesis 2. So I don't think you're going to find those today. Yes?
Presently, you're saying Pishon River is in Saudi Arabia. Is it named correctly?
We don't really know where the Pishon River was. I don't know if there is a river called the Pishon River, not a major one in Saudi Arabia. In fact, is there any major river in Saudi Arabia? Saudi Arabia is kind of devoid of any of these major rivers. And the Gihon, we call the Gihon Spring in Jerusalem, this little spring that provides water for Jerusalem after the Gihon, but it's obviously not the Gihon of the Garden of Eden. So people have taken these names, popular names from Genesis 2, and they've applied them to other rivers. What's the point? The flood was far more climactic than anybody ever gives credit for. I mean, it's you can look up some of the things on YouTube about this, about the flood, that would be quite amazing about this, that really helps prove the universal flood. In any case, what you need is obviously water, and a lot of water to sustain populations. This is why we have the various peoples that were congregating there in the land of Canaan. If there was no Sea of Galilee, if there was no source even of the Sea of Galilee, then you're not even going to have water in the Sea of Galilee. But the water that empties into the Sea of Galilee from the north come from Nahal Sanir, which is a very small lake that doesn't exist anymore, but because the modern Israel has dredged this whole thing, it used to be a swampy area, and they've taken all this out now up in the northern part of Israel. But in antiquity, it was there, and water from Mount Hermon would flow on down, ice and snow that would melt would go into the Nahal Sanir, and then that would go into the northern part of the Sea of Galilee. So the Sea of Galilee had an inlet at the top and had an outlet at the bottom. In that sense, it was a very, very fresh lake because it had this flow that was going through it, and the fish would congregate to the northern part of it because that was where the freshest water was coming into it. And the Old Testament was called the Sea of Kinneret in many ways. Anyone recognize what Kinneret? Musical instrument, yes. And what kind of instrument? Actually a harp. It's a harp. So the Hebrew, kinneret, means a liar, or not someone who tells lies, okay, you know. A liar in terms of a stringed instrument for popular as well as sacred music. What they could see was, even though they couldn't fly, they could be up at the top of Mount Arbel, you know, up above Sea of Galilee. They could look down and go, wow, this Sea of Galilee is really actually the shape of a harp. So that's what they called it, Harp Sea, Harp Lake, or Lake of Kinneret, Sea of Kinneret. It's also called Sea of Galilee, because the region of the north was named Galilee. Why was it called Galilee? Not sure I know why. I would have to be interesting to see the origins of that as well. But it emptied into the Jordan River, even though the Sea of Galilee is below sea level. It still was higher than the Jordan River. As you know, water has to flow downwards. And the Jordan River, obviously, then would be below sea level. And the Jordan River, very interesting. It's 105 kilometers from the Sea of Galilee to the Salt Sea. But it's such a windy sea that if you took all of that windiness, that serpentine, snake-like thing, and then you stretched it all out, it'd actually be more than twice the length. It's actually 250. If you're going to go in a boat down the Sea of Galilee, it's going to take you twice as long. 215 kilometers. I remember going, crossing the Sea of Galilee the Jordan River the first time. I was in Amman, Jordan with a tour group. I was leading a tour of Jordan and then of Israel. And we crossed on over. We crossed the same way from the east to the west, the same way that Joshua did. And I thought, well, this is pretty exciting. It was my first time to ever do this. So I was pretty excited about it. And I was up in the front of the tour bus and go, okay, everybody get ready, because we're going to cross the same river the same way Joshua crossed. And everybody's looking out. And we cross this tiny, looked like just a tiny little spring, you know, a couple times the width of the classroom, two or three times the width of the classroom. And I thought, that was a little strange. I asked my tour guide, got off the microphone. He said, hey, when are we going to get, how long before we cross the Jordan? And he goes, we just did. I said, what? That was it? I was pumping this all up for our tour group. And that was it, right? You know, that, like that little pond that we just crossed there? You know? He goes, oh, that was it. And then I realized, oh, that's right. Joshua 3. So that says that they crossed during the flood zone, the flood time. And what that means is that the river would get swollen higher and higher, and it would fill in all this area between this very serpentine thing. And it was a massive, massive amount of water rushing on by, very wide to cross. And so then I realized, oh yeah, okay, it still was a miracle. It was a miracle for Joshua to cross it at flood stage when God dried the whole thing up. It wasn't such a miracle for us to cross our bridge, you know, in a boat, in a bus. So that was where it went down to the Salt Sea. Salt Sea is what we call the Sea of Galilee right now. That's what it was called during the times of, you know, the Old Testament times, because it gets saltier and saltier. I was reading an article on Salt Sea a couple days ago, and the point of the article is Israel continues to, and Jordan continues to pull so much water out of the Jordan River right now for their growing populations, that the Salt Sea continues to get lower, or the Dead Sea, we call it now, keeps getting lower and lower and lower, and it's actually, within 20 to 30 years, it's in danger of actually disappearing altogether. Because as the lowest place on the planet, the only way water can get out of it is to evaporate. So there's no other place where it can flow, because there's no place where water flows upstream, you know? And so that was a major sea at that time. And then, of course, the Mediterranean, we call the Mediterranean, they call the Great Sea. By the way, Mediterranean, what does Mediterranean mean? Medi? Medi also means between, like between. And then Terranean? You've got the terrain of Europe and the terrain of Africa. So Mediterranean means water between Europe and Africa. A great name for a sea, right? It's one of those words that just sort of goes by us and we never really think about what they mean, you know? What about regions of the Old Testament in terms of zeroing in now on Israel? In the south, you've got Judah in the broad scope. We realize that this was divided into 12 different tribes. But let's just look at in the big picture right now. Judah, of the tribe of Judah, next to Jerusalem. All right, this is page 18 of your notes. And then the Sea of Galilee up at the top, of course, was, or the Sea of Kinneret, was, of course, in the region of Galilee. And then when Israel broke up into two different nations, the northern one, interestingly, was the one that retained the name Israel. Even though God's covenant stayed with the southern kingdom, the covenant that God gave to Israel, the father of the 12 tribes. So, upper right, then you've got Bashan or Bashan. It's not mentioned too much in Amos. Amos talks about the cows of Bashan, these fat ladies who lived up there and ordered their husbands to get drinks for them. Do you ever remember that passage? This is where Bashan or Bashan, up in the north, a wealthy area. We call that the Golan Heights now. And what about these other locations on the eastern side of the Jordan River? If you make a game of it, it can help you remember. Yeah, Gilead. So the G can stand for Gilead, which is close to Galilee, which is near the modern Golan. Is that helpful? All the G's are up there in the north, right? But if you make a game of this and you think of the G followed by an A and then an M and then an E, aha, there's your game. I make these little games. This is what got me through 7 years of seminary, you know, in a row. I went straight on through. I had 3.5 years of my master's and 3.5 years of my doctorate. I call it my 7-year tribulation. I invented a lot of these games to help me to remember these sort of things. Here's one of them. Gilead is what we're talking about for the G up at the north. A is for?
Ammon.
Yeah. You can remember that because it's the same for Rabbah Ammon today. Ammon, Jordan, is the capital of Jordan. And it's in that same region. Name goes all the way back to Ammon. The Moabite people lived here, such as Ruth and others, Balak. And then finally, Edom would be the E. So there's your G-A-M-E, your little game to help you remember the people who lived on the eastern side. All right, you could put Golan up there, but Golan's not really an ancient word up in the north that I recall. Questions about that? You feel like you're getting a handle on this? You know, one thing I just noticed on the eastern side is you've got Jig, J-I-G. Hey, what's the Jig, you know? Yes, Robin?
Northern Israel means Samaria and Galilee.
Samaria in the Old Testament times was the name of a city, the capital city of the northern kingdom. when we get to, well, let's move on into New Testament, and you'll see how this fits in. The next slide is New Testament. Instead of Judah in the south, it becomes called Judea. And we have the Judean mountains there. Galilee retains its name in the north, but there is no real country of that's distinguishing Israel and Judah when you get the New Testament, because it's really all one country. So we're not, there's no more divided kingdom here. But there has to be some area in there, don't you think? So with this area, that's some area. What do they call some area? They call it Samaria. That Samaria, the capital city of the northern kingdom in the Old Testament, becomes the name for the region of Samaria in the New Testament. So Jesus, as we see in John 4, says he had to go through Samaria. Why did he have to go through Samaria? Because he needed to teach his disciples some lessons about how valuable the Samaritan people were. Even though the Jews despised them as half-breeds, as you have the Gentiles in the north of Galilee, many of the Gentiles, and the Jews of the south in Judea. Do you get it? Judea, and then Gentile at the top. In between, you've got the people who were the product of the in-between. They were the people who were the descendants of those who intermarried and despised Samaritans. So Jesus, instead of going along the Jordan Rift route and making his way up that way to Galilee, Jesus had to go through Samaria because he had to tell the disciples how valuable this Samaritan woman was, who had five husbands and was living together with the man that she was with at that point.
So Gentiles, which one are you saying? Gentiles.
We had more Gentiles living up in the north, up in Galilee, during the New Testament times than we did in the south. So I'm putting the G for Gentile as to match with the G for Galilee. You had some Gentiles here in the south, but Galilee was more of a despised area, especially by those who lived in Judea. They despised the Jews who lived up in Galilee because... What's that? The ones who lived in, the Jews who lived in Galilee were more despised. They were not close to Jerusalem. They were looked at as less pure. We're getting the New Testament backgrounds now, which is a lot of fun too. But.
So it means Gentiles also lived?
Yeah. You have Galilean Gentiles, but you have Galilean Jews as well. You see a bit of how the Judean Jews despise the Galilean Jews when Peter goes and denies Jesus, actually. And they say to him, as he's warming himself by the fire the night that Jesus was betrayed, you're sure a Galilean. We can tell by your accent. It's a very derogatory thing. It'd be like me saying, well, I can sure tell that you're from, you know, the poor area of England. You're talking English, but I can hardly understand you, you know. It'd be me looking very disparagingly down at someone whose English was different than my English. And I consider my English to be more pure or whatever. That's what these Jews were saying.
Yeah, maybe that's a type of village type of place. Yeah.
That is true as well, that there were more villages. You didn't have any large cities up there. You did Jerusalem.
How do you say it's a Gentiles?
We see in Nazareth, for example, Gentiles, because Nazareth was the center of the Roman centurions during the time of Jesus. That was where the Roman soldiers had made their headquarters. So you could see why the Jews would despise Nazareth. Do you remember when Jesus was just meeting the disciples in John chapter 1, and Philip goes to his brother Andrew And he says, "Hey, we found the Messiah." And I suspect what was in Andrew's mind, the Messiah, oh, the guy who's born in Bethlehem, yeah, you know. He goes, "And he's from Nazareth." But no, it's Nathaniel, actually. Nathaniel says, "Nazareth? Can anything good come from Nazareth?" So they were despising, even the Jews were despising other Jews that were from Nazareth because of the Gentiles. So this were their conquerors, their occupiers from their perspective. That's where they lived. So you have these despised cities up there. They were not, you know. Yes, go ahead. All of Jesus' disciples were from Galilee, which is a good word to us, isn't it? Jesus knew the people's perspective toward Galilee, and yet he purposely picked Galilean disciples. That just goes totally against the way that I think. I often think, I'm going to go be with this person because this person's got great potential. This person's well-respected in society, and this person can help turn that world upside down. I want to be around people who are influencers. The Lord really rebuked me for having that perspective. And honestly, I'll tell you just my own priority. A lot of people, and I respect people having different ideas about who they want to influence and all that. It's not my goal in my life to be a major influence among others who have PhDs in Bible. You know, a lot of them, their viewpoints are really quite set. And they look down on me because I take the Bible in a very, I just call it a normal way. I don't really worry about them. I don't think they are really the ones who are the great influencers of our world today. I think the real influencers are people like you and me. I think just average people like us are the ones that God wants to use. And so we see Jesus making the focus of his ministry up there in Galilee. He picks the city of Capernaum there at the top in a despised area of Israel. And we find the same thing all through the Bible. He doesn't pick the people of great influence mostly. He picks just the normal people who will give him the glory for what they're doing. We see the Decapolis also there. I'm jumping in New Testament, even though this is Old Testament backgrounds, just so you see where all this goes. Decapolis means, didn't anyone know? Deca means 10. Polis. Metropolis. Cities, yeah. 10 cities. Decapolis means 10 cities. These were 10 Greek cities that were spread throughout this area, one of which was called Philadelphia. Rabbah. Amman, Jordan, was one of those 10 cities. City of brotherly love. It has reverted to its ancient name of Amman now. But there were 10 cities spread throughout this area in the New Testament. Another area was Perea, south of that. This is where John the Baptist was baptizing. Why would John go all the way over? Why would he baptize in Perea? Why wouldn't he find some pools in Jerusalem? Someday we'll have to ask him that question, right? But I think John, his goal was not to make everything so easy.
At that time, there was a division with the Jerusalem and some priests who went in the streets, scrolls, Assyrians. So,
there was a division in Jerusalem about
division between the Jerusalem priesthood, and there was some priests living in the mountains.
Yes, yes.
Which we got the scrolls.
This division started around 200 BC,
yeah,
between the high priest of Simon,
yeah, some say,
and what became known as the Hasidim, or the,
yeah,
or the pious ones, and they decided we didn't want any part of this, so they moved on out to the desert. So they moved on out to Perea refers to being on the other side of the Jordan, but they moved out to a place here called Qumran. And we'll study them later. We'll have a session on the Dead Sea Scrolls that come from this area. But yeah, that was their perspective as well. We don't have to be the high and mighty. We need to be the faithful ones to the Lord. Faithful to do what God would have us to do. Finally, we have Arabia and the lower part. This is before the Saudis came about in the last 100 years, the Saudi regime. The Saudis have added that to the beginning of it, so they call it Saudi Arabia. But we don't have to worry about that. And then Idumea was another area that came into focus, especially through Herod the Great, who was an Idumean. In other words, he was also like a Samaritan. He was like a half Jew. He really wasn't a full Jew. And this is one of the reasons why at the time of Jesus' birth, the people didn't really accept him. But he got the power from Rome, and he was close to Judea, but not fully.
I see we're about ready to take a break now. So let's take a break, and then we'll continue, and we'll talk about some of these places on an individual basis.